Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Food Friday, April 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Now, it may not seem like it outside, but the calendar indicates that it's spring. I keep saying it's spring on all these introductions, and one of these times I'll be right. Once the temperatures warm up, fresh local produce will be hitting store shelves and filling area farmers markets. In the studio with tips for using these ingredients is food writer and photographer Peter Barrett. If you're interested in adding fresh vegetables and herbs to your diet, this, my friend, is the program for you. And the number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Peter Barrett's here. We talk wild greens and rhubarb and parsnips and whatever. It starts after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. The calendar has turned to spring, and at some point the temperatures will warm up, and fresh local produce will hit the store shelves and will fill area farmers markets. In the studio with tips today for using these ingredients is food writer and photographer Peter Barrett. He has been a food writer in the Hudson Valley for more than a decade, currently runs acookblog.com. He's the author and photographer of Project 258, Making Dinner at Fish and Game, about the James Beard Award-winning restaurant in Hudson. But his primary focus has always been on home cooking. He grows, preserves, and cooks as much of his own food as possible and teaches others to do the same through his writing and classes. If you have a question, maybe you need a tip how to incorporate local produce into your diet, now's the time to call Food Friday, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. Peter Barrett, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You were an artist.
Yes.
You still are an artist.
I suppose I am. I do covert drawings in my basement when no one's looking.
Well, how did you end up so fascinated and maybe even obsessed by food?
I grew up, my mom's side of the family were really avid gardeners, cooks. My grandfather made pickles and smoked chickens, and my grandmother was a serious cook. My mom picked up on that and had a big garden when I was growing up, baked bread.
Yeah.
That was part of the rhythm of life. It was part of what you did, and I connected to that. When I moved up here with my family about a dozen years ago from Brooklyn, one of my big motivations for doing so was so that I could have a garden. It really, yeah. Starting to feel it, you know, yeah. On a visceral level, the need to grow things in dirt. And as great as the markets are in the city, it's not the same. So I put in a garden in Woodstock and started writing about what I made with it. Geeking out on all kinds of pickling and fermentation and curing meat and starting to ferment all kinds of vinegars and making hot sauces and just, you know, the things that you can do, especially once you move out of the city and you can leave some of your type A ambition behind and channel it into new pursuits in the country, which I really, really enjoyed. So I just kind of kept writing about what I cooked and kept cooking about what I was seeing and feeling and thinking when I was outside working in the garden and reading a lot, because the food internet was really starting to snowball right around then. This would have been, I moved up in 06, so it was really starting to become nothing like the juggernaut that it is now, but it was really starting to take shape.
And, yeah.
So there was a lot of information and there was a lot of conversation among the sort of early, the first wave of food bloggers.
Yeah.
And it sort of got me to a place where I was able to talk to Brian Mahoney at Chronogram and pitch myself as their food writer, which he, to my sort of eternal delight, that he gave me the gig right away on the basis of the blog. So then I did that for a while, and I wrote for Edible Hudson Valley and a bunch of other things, and then I met the guys at Fish and Game.
And the book, by the way, Project 258. Now, I know you were on with Joe a year ago or around there
almost
on the roundtable.
Exactly.
This is one honking book here. Tell us about this and how this came to be.
Well, it was after we met and I spent some time with them to write an article for Edible. I emailed Zach and his wife, Jory, and said that we should make a book together because we really hit it off. We got each other, liked each other, enjoyed each other's company right out of the gate, and we would be good friends if we weren't working together. So, I sent them a very brief email saying we should make a book, but the world doesn't really need another cookbook. So we should make a long form book where I spend a couple years with you guys. And we make a book about the passage of time and your collaboration with it, because so many of these fermentation and other processes take a year or longer.
Yeah.
And if I could be there at the beginning, the middle, and the end of all these processes, which overlap based on the time that the product becomes ripe and then the time that the fermentation is complete and all these in-between things, we should try to convey some, both visually and in terms of the content, we should convey something about how this sort of slow food concept really works in the world.
It's quite a bit of dedication required to say, look, this will take 2 years.
Well, it took three, actually.
It took 3 years.
I was sort of artist in residence at the restaurant for two, and then I spent the third year putting it all together, working with the designer, dealing with layout, editing, cutting, adding, subtracting.
The photographs are just spectacular in this book. What did you learn over those 2 years that you were embedded?
I learned how to take a photograph.
Well, you must have known something about art to begin with.
I did. The visual training, absolutely, in terms of composition and just having a sense of what a good image, what a powerful image looks like and feels like, that was absolutely there. But I began the process as a competent photographer, but I finished the process as a much better one because I just took so many pictures and had to really focus on this documentary approach. We didn't pose things. We didn't stage things. We shot things as they were.
I guess my question really was, what did you learn about food and about life in those 2 years?
Well, it's funny. This morning I was thinking about how a year used to be a long time. You know, when you're a kid, a year is like an eternity.
Yeah. It gets shorter and shorter, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah. It really does. I know it's a cliche, but it's alarming, actually, at sometimes how quickly things go by. And one of the reasons I like to go outside and work in the garden and pick some of the wild things that I brought you today is that I find that kind of direct connection to a simple process involving nature really slows time down. And it really creates sort of larger moments that you can be inside. And it's sort of to me, it's a good antidote to this sort of increasingly hectic wider world.
We're joined today by Peter Barrett, who is a food writer and photographer. The book is Project 258, Making Dinner at Fish and Game, and at some point we'll talk about wild things and some of the stuff you brought. You started this blog in 2006?
February, I believe, of 2006, yeah.
And I imagine, since I can only guess you were not a fully trained chef, you did a lot of learning and writing about things that you later perhaps said, oh, gosh, I got that wrong.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. To go back to your question, which I managed to not answer a second time.
I'm used to that, so that's fine.
Okay. One of the things that I learned is the fundamental way in which home cooking is different from restaurant cooking. Now, a restaurant like Fish and Game, the part of what they do, certainly back when they used to have the tasting menu as opposed to now when it's more of an a la carte situation, but part of what they did was have everything change every week. New dishes would come on and old dishes would go off, and there was very little repetition. Now it's more of a set menu. But I learned that one of the things that I love about cooking and about growing food honestly, the reason I'm here today is because even though especially today, right, when it's snowing, but
yeah.
There's actually more going on outside when everything's gray and brown, right? This is sort of the ugliest month of the year, right? But there's actually a lot going on. And so if you slow down and look down and poke around and maybe move some leaves aside, there's actually a fair amount of food to be found right out there. I should also mention while we're in this kind of gray and gross period, that the above freezing days and below freezing nights are when the maple sap flows.
Mm.
So this kind of shoulder season is what makes maple syrup possible. The trees start pulling all this energy and nutrition out of their roots and sending it up into the branches, and that's what we tap and cook down. Everyone knows about maple syrup, so we don't need to talk about that. But I do want to extol the virtues of sap.
Just really?
As a drinking, just as a beverage, it's about 2-2.5% sugar. I brought you a
You brought sap, and my producer, Jim Lavula, said, hey, you'll be drinking sap today, and mm-hmm.
It's not pine sap, so you've got that going for
never
you.
Never had a sip of sap.
It looks like very slightly cloudy water for everyone out in Radio Land. It
certainly does.
And it's about 2-2.5% sugar, and it's got some minerals and other nutrients that the tree uses to build itself.
You want a shot?
Sure.
Okay, absolutely. There you go. You can drink it right out of the sap jar. Cheers.
And it has a nice, light, slightly maple-y flavor.
That's not what I expected. It's rather refreshing.
Right.
All right, let me have a couple of shots of this. We'll take a break here. Our guest today is Peter Barrett, 800-348-2551. And we'll find out all the good stuff Peter brought for us to try here on a Food Friday. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Department of Theater Arts, SUNY New Paltz, presenting Avenue Q, a bawdy musical following the people, puppets, pranks of a precocious neighborhood, April 19th through 29th, newpaltz.edu/theater. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world, waldorfsaratoga.org. Cafe Capriccio, Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grant Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com. Holiday Brook Farm, a fourth-generation farm raising grass-fed beef, lamb, and pastured pork, offering black gold compost, 100 Holiday Cottage Road, Dalton, Massachusetts, 413-684-0444. And Rolling Rock Farm Salt and Seasonings, Sheffield, Massachusetts. Handcrafted in small batches, infused sea salts, peppers, and blends, specializing in garlic and hot pepper blends, rollingrocksalt.com for upcoming events.
Well, the sap is lovely, and I really appreciate Peter Barrett bringing the sap today on the program. 800-348-2551 is the number on a Food Friday, and we talk spring things and wild things today with food blogger and photographer and writer Peter Barrett. The bread is delicious as
Thanks.
Well. What is that?
So it's a sourdough that I make with my wild sourdough starter that a friend actually gave me about a decade ago, and you just keep it alive by feeding it a mixture of flour and water every few days.
Yeah.
Then when you're about to bake, you feed it a couple times a day for a couple days, and it gets really bubbly. And then you use that in place of yeast, and it imparts a lot of character, a nice sour flavor. And
it's really good.
For this, I substituted maple sap for the water. So the little bit of sugar in the sap gives the yeast something extra delicious to eat, and it makes the bread. You get a noticeable increase in the height of the loaf and the nice open nature of the crumb, which is what it's called. It's not too dense.
And no, it's beautiful.
Cakey, it sort of opens up. It's and it's another use for the liquid. I also brought you some pork belly that I braised in maple sap.
You're kidding me.
I am not.
You had me at pork belly.
Yeah, and that's homemade bacon, so that's braised after it was sort of baconized. Then I sliced it and cooked it really slowly in some sap, and then reduced the sap to make a sort of bacony maple syrup that I then tossed it with. And it's got a little ramp kimchi from a couple of years ago and a little bit of peach chutney from last July when the peaches got so big that two branches broke off my tree. So I had to
do chutney.
I had to do chutney because they weren't ripe. So, yeah.
Speaking of bread, have you ever had a chance to interview in your writing career Amy Halloran, the bread lady?
I have not.
Oh, you got to talk bread with her.
Okay, I'd love to.
I bet she hasn't tried using sap instead of water. So.
I have to confess, I'm a competent bread baker, but I'm still really a tourist.
She's a genius. So yeah. You want to talk to her. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Peter Barrett is our guest today. What else did you bring?
So this salad is entirely picked from what used to be my front yard and is now my garden.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's a mixture. I threw a little vinaigrette on there, which is just some olive oil and some homemade herb vinegar that I made in the fall. And so this is a mixture of things that are wild that just popped up. Some things that overwintered in the garden, like spinach, which is indestructible,
yeah.
Out unprotected all winter long, just happy as can be as soon as the snow melts. And so you've got some herbs, some bee balm, some there's dandelion in there, a little bit of violet, some arugula, which I planted in February under protection. I make hoops covered in plastic,
yep.
For a few beds so I can get a jump on the season. And a few other... Mash, which M-A-C-H-E, which is a really cold-tolerant, really buttery, tender salad green, and some sorrel, which is a perennial. It's nice and bright and lemony. I brought you some sorrel pesto as well. For
terrific. We'll try that later on.
So this is a salad picked yesterday because I knew it was going to snow right outside my house, and half of it is stuff that grows whether I want it to or not.
That is so interesting that you picked this at this time of year,
yeah.
And it's so delicious and springy and really nice. Of course, if you did it from my lawn, it would be just a crabgrass salad.
You know, you say that, but I have to say my old place in Woodstock, my yard was about 10% wild garlic.
Yeah.
The garlic chives, they're a little darker than grass.
Mm-hmm.
They're not flat. They're cylindrical. They're hollow. They smell very strongly of garlic, and they grow quicker. So you see these darker green tufts,
yeah.
Poking up.
Sure.
That's all edible. And they have little white bulbs that you can chop up like garlic, and they have greens that you can use to in salads or to make this pesto that I made you, which is half sorrel, half garlic chive.
Huh.
And they also don't die in the winter. So as soon as the snow melts back, you have these beautiful bright green things that are good to eat.
Peter Barrett is our guest, and let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. We'll go over to Nancy in Schenectady. Nancy, you're on. We're going to pot Nancy up. Hello.
So here you mentioned that violets were among the things you... we're putting in the salad you made. I was going to mention the use of violet leaves as, they're a wonderful salad green. I use them quite a lot during the spring, as well as, if you're familiar, well, garlic mustard, which grows all over the place, and it's kind of invasive, but if more people ate it, maybe we'd be able to keep it under control better.
You're absolutely right. I'm glad you brought it up because that was on my list to talk about. It is invasive, and it spreads.
Okay, yeah.
It spreads very aggressively.
And a friend of mine actually makes pesto with that. I haven't done that myself, but I think it's a good idea. And I heard you mention the sorrel pesto.
Mm-hmm.
Pesto. Which I think is a great idea.
Yeah, pesto doesn't have to be just basil. It can be pretty
right.
much any tender green herb.
But then it's like a martini without gin. Is it really a martini?
Well, I think pesto serves better than martini for a generic green puree of herbs,
okay.
And with some oil. And
do you use garlic in it then?
This one I didn't because I used garlic chives and sorrel.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But I was, I'm so glad you called because the... garlic chives and garlic mustard and ramps, which we can get to in a bit because they're sort of the poster children for spring.
Sure.
But the if you're an amateur forager, if it smells strongly of garlic, it is safe to eat. So those three herbs, one of which garlic mustard really should be yanked up by the roots in order to keep it from seeding and spreading. The roots actually can be treated like horseradish, so you can grate them. Use it however you'd like to use horseradish.
Oh, that's good to know.
And because if you don't pull the roots up, they'll grow back. So if you see it,
yeah.
It has these very tender heart-shaped leaves, and it really is delicious, and it
uh-huh.
really, really is spreading and becoming a problem in New York. So.
Well, Nancy, thank you for the call. Our guest today is Peter Barrett. Are you an obsessive forager?
I wouldn't say obsessive, but every year I try and learn a few more things.
Yeah.
I took on mushrooms pretty hard a few years ago.
You got to be careful.
You do. You do have to be careful.
Know what you're doing. You only get one chance.
You do. I want to plug the Mid-Hudson Mycological Association,
all right,
who
sir.
Took me on some walks. It's a very affordable annual membership, and they host walks almost every weekend in season.
Mm-hmm.
And you will learn a powerful amount from some really nice people.
That's
and
great.
And get to really understand the region, too. You go on some great hikes, that sometimes on private land, that you wouldn't otherwise be able to. So mushrooms are tricky, definitely not for just a casual dalliance.
Yes.
That's the reason I'm so glad we had that call, because the green herbs that smell strongly of garlic are the things that you think they are.
You know, we have done a few shows on foraging on Food Friday over the years, and they're always among the most popular. People who like to forage really like to forage.
It's free food.
Yeah. As long as you do it properly.
Absolutely. You do need to be responsible. But we have a lot of experts. In fact, apart from my book, the other book that I brought,
okay.
is by a woman named Dina Falcone.
She's been on.
Yeah,
in
Accord.
It's been several years, but she's been on.
It's a beautiful book. And for anybody wanting to learn the wild plants of this region that are good to eat, it is one-stop shopping. So can't say enough good things about it.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Peter Barrett, our guest today on Food Friday. And let's go to another Peter. This one is in West Stockbridge. You're on.
Hey, Ray. Hey, Peter.
Hello.
I got 12 trees tapped out here in Maple Street in West Stockbridge. And my wife makes her coffee with sap instead of regular water. I don't know if you've tried that, but she says it adds a really lovely sweetness to her coffee.
With sap?
That's a terrific idea.
Yeah.
I will do that.
Yeah.
I sometimes freeze ice cube trays of it and then put them in cocktails and just because it's a little more interesting than water.
There you go.
I have another question.
Sure.
So President's Day is the day I put my taps in.
Mm-hmm.
And that morning it was zero when I woke up and 40 at 9 a.m. And for the next couple of weeks, it was a beautiful run. And I think I put up 3 gallons of syrup.
Nice.
I haven't gotten any sap out of the trees in, I think, 4 or 5 weeks now.
Yeah,
it's. And I'm waiting for another run. Is there something I'm doing wrong?
No, there isn't. Well, we collectively as people are making the weather crazy, so that it absolutely impacts the sap flow. What I can tell you is, I do it now, going back 6 or 8 years with a friend of mine who lives in Bearsville, west of Woodstock, and we were going to boil this last Monday. And there just wasn't any sap flow for the week prior because it just got too warm. What you need is below freezing nights and above freezing days. And it was that for a while, which is when you were getting your flow, and we got a lot too. But it looks like the last couple days and the coming week are going to fit that bill, at least where I am in the sort of Woodstock area. And you're probably not too far off of that in Stockbridge. So keep your fingers crossed. Don't pull the taps out. And I think you should get one good solid boil still this season.
All right, Peter, thank you for the call. And our guest today is Peter Barrett. Cookblog.com is the website. Project 258, Making Dinner at Fish and Game, is the book. And you better have a big coffee table for that one. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Martin in Sheffield. Martin, you're on.
Hello. I understand dandelion leaves are edible. Are the blossoms edible too?
The whole plant is root, leaf, and flower. Absolutely. I wouldn't eat the fluffy white seeds that blow around in the wind.
No.
I wouldn't eat those. But yes, the roots, you can roast them and grind them and add them to your coffee. That's, if you've ever heard of chicory coffee, that's basically that's roasted dandelion root. I made some bitters last fall using dandelion root in place of gentian, which is what gives bitters their bitterness. And the flowers, you can steep them and with honey or sugar and make dandelion wine. You can pull the petals out of the base of the flower and sprinkle them on food for a nice yellow garnish. You can add them to salads. Absolutely. They're really nice if you're making something like, I don't know, like a sort of salmon tartare or something, and you throw some dandelion leaves in there. It gives it a beautiful color. But yes, they actually taste nice. They're not as good as the leaves. Leaves have a really beautiful bitterness, and they look terrific with the deep serrated edges. But yeah, the whole thing's edible and good for you.
All right, Martin, thank you very much for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. You ever have dandelion wine?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that making booze, apart from infusing things like I did last fall to make some of these liqueurs, one of which I brought you.
Oh, well, nice.
I have never tried to ferment any alcohol. I make all kinds of vinegar and kimchi and miso. I make a lot of different ferments, but I've never tried to make beer, wine, or other booze from scratch.
I had dandelion wine once. And that will be
didn't really do it for you. Yeah, I mean, I've had some amateur dandelion and elderberry and other kind of home brews, and a lot of times, I mean, the worst mistake I think is when people use baking yeast to ferment it, because then it just tastes like yeast, which is not a pleasant thing.
No, it wasn't pleasant.
You want to find a wild yeast source, like some unsprayed organic apple peel or some grapes. That hazy, kind of cloudy film that you see on grapes or that you would buff off of an apple.
Yeah,
that's yeast. And so if you have fruit that hasn't been sprayed or treated with any pesticides, then you can just use that yeast to start a much more natural and much less yeasty tasting situation. I mean, sometimes those yeasts are going to be a little weird, but It's much more fun to experiment that way.
Peter Barrett, our guest. Our number on this Food Friday is 800-348-2551. And Herb and Saugerties. Herb, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. You know, every once in a while around this, maybe around this time of year, I see these fiddlehead ferns that I get at the market. Are they, first of all, I'm looking for some ideas on how to cook them. I've done it a few times. They're pretty tasty, but looking for your ideas there. And second of all, do they grow wildly? Would that, is that something I might find in, you know, in the forest or something, a fiddlehead fern?
Yes, absolutely. Right around, depending on, you know, the this radio station reaches a very big geographical region, so it's more or less fully spring down at the southern edge of it, and it's still fully winter at the northern edge of it. So your latitude is going to have a lot to do with that in terms of when they come up. But yeah, walk in the woods, you'll see them. They look exactly the way they do at the store, these little tightly coiled spirals. There are a couple different kinds of ferns that are prominent in our region. And off the top of my head, I don't remember the names of the ones that are, to my taste, better and less good to eat. A quick sauté or a quick blanch in some salted water, followed by a sauté, will keep them on the brighter and crunchier side. They don't, in my opinion, benefit from long, slow cooking. I think they just kind of get bitter and swampy. So I would keep them, but also raw, they can be a little assertive and tough. So I would go for either a quick sauté or a quick blanch followed by a sauté, something like that.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to say was I see them like for a couple of weeks and then they're gone. Is that, they have like a very short
Well, they uncoil and become ferns. Yeah, that's what they do.
Ah, well, makes sense.
All right, Herb, thanks for the call. And our guest today is Peter Barrett on this Food Friday. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ralph in Greenfield, Mass. Ralph, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? You hear me okay on speakerphone here?
Yeah, we generally don't like the speakerphone, but yours sounds pretty darn good, so go ahead.
Well, that's not the phone. That's just me.
Fine.
Okay. I have a couple of comments. First one about mushrooms. You had a foraging expert on some time ago.
Oh, yeah.
She was adamant about people not doing wild mushrooms.
Yep.
And I've been doing them for years. It's not that I'm so much of an expert as that there are at least a dozen. I'm in Western Massachusetts, and there are at least a dozen kinds of mushrooms that are absolutely unmistakable and completely delicious, and there's no reason in the world not to go out and find them and pick them. They can't be mistaken for anything else.
Okay,
there are
but
many edible mushrooms which look very much like poisonous mushrooms, and don't do those.
Okay, okay, well, before I let Peter respond, just remember, and this is what I think our guest talked about all that time, you need to know what you're doing or you can get very
exactly
sick and maybe die. So you know what you're doing because you're still on the phone and you sound like you're alive. But Peter, you go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there are some common and very delicious mushrooms in our region that do not have any toxic lookalikes. Morels are probably the most distinctive. A lot of people say chanterelles too, and they are, except that jack-o'-lanterns are not that dissimilar, and to an amateur eye, it can be difficult sometimes to tell them apart. There are also several different kinds of chanterelles, which look fairly different from each other. I gotta agree with Ray that the best thing that you can do is spend some time with experts. And really, there are some excellent books. There's even an Audubon Society app about mushrooms that I have on my phone, and you should too.
Great.
That's great for IDing things. You know, oyster mushrooms also pretty distinct and hard to mistake. But again, it's the downside can be fairly extreme. So
yeah,
this is not something where you want to just wander out into the woods. You want to spend time with real experts and get some hours and specific knowledge under your belt before you just
absolutely. And the book which I find most helpful is called Mushrooms Demystified, and though it was written in California, I have found very, very little, if any, variation between mushrooms here in Massachusetts and what is plainly edible in California, and I just stay away from the lookalikes. The other thing I wanted to say is that I do a lot of spring foraging. It usually starts with ramps, then goes to fiddleheads, and then goes to morels.
Mm-hmm.
But what else can you find really, really early in the season. And I'll take your answer, but then I want to say something to Ray before I go.
Uh-oh, that doesn't sound too good. All right, go ahead, Peter.
Well, we covered a couple. I'm a huge fan of the garlic chives. Ramps get a lot of the spring green hype because they're wild, because they're one of the first things up, and because they're, you know, super pungent and beautiful. They are slow growing, and they, because they're scarce and take labor to harvest, they're expensive, so people can make real money going out and digging up massive amounts of them. So I am reluctant to endorse ramps beyond saying that if you have a good patch, cut one leaf per plant and don't dig them up. It can take up to 10 years for a ramp to... They reproduce, like most alliums, by either dividing underground or producing seeds or both. But a ramp plant can take 10 years before it actually flowers and makes seeds, and they divide fairly slowly. So if they're under a lot of harvesting pressure, they're just going to diminish. So if you cut one leaf per plant and leave the bulb alone, the one leaf will photosynthesize and they will thrive and you will always have your ramp patch. But the garlic chives that are almost certainly in your lawn and all over the place, they are indomitable, and they breed like crazy. They're everywhere. They're delicious. They come back in the fall. They actually live under the snow all winter long. They don't die back. So I want to give them an extra enthusiastic plug, because they should be the new ramp, because they're extremely sustainable and delicious.
All right, Ralph, we have to take a break here, but you can tell me what you have to tell me as long as it's clean. Go ahead.
I just want to know, your playing out music has some of the most astonishing syncopation that just gets me going every time. Is that bassy? I thought maybe by the end of that.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up.
That is
called Slewfoot. That's a Neil Hefti composition that he did with Basie in somewhere late 50s, and it's my favorite thing. You'll hear it coming up.
That gets me every day.
I love it, man. Well, thanks for the call. We got to take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Peter Barrett, our guest on Food Friday. We'll be right back.
Support for WMT comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear featuring new styles for 2018. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. River Valley Co-op, Northampton, Massachusetts, a food co-op featuring fresh local foods, a deli department with made-to-order sandwiches, a soup and salad bar, and a bakery, rivervalley.coop. New York Oncology Hematology, welcoming WAMC listeners to its 5th annual Spring to Life Conference, Saturday, May 19th. CME credit available for healthcare professionals. NewYorkOncology.com for registration. The Egremont Village Inn, presenting Cosmos Sunshine on Friday, April 6th, and Bucky Hayes on Saturday, April 7th. Dinner served at 5 p.m. Tickets and information at TheEgremontBarn.com. And Pekarsky's, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, family-owned since 1948, offering sausages from kielbasa to Italian to bratwurst and smoked meats. Home of New England farm-made sausage. Open 7 days. Pekarskys.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop Food Friday. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. And Peter Barrett is our guest. Acookblog.com is his website. And this one came in via email from Rick in Whitesboro. How do you prepare the maple sap so that it does not give you intestinal distress? It happened to me, and a friend said it'll happen.
I have never had that problem.
Oh, good heavens.
Drink it straight out of the tree.
Really?
Ice cold. One of the great pleasures of boiling sap, which, as I said, I've been doing now for a long time with my buddy Danny outside Woodstock, is that you start in the frigid morning drinking ice cold sap, and then as the day winds on and it reduces, it gets sweeter, and so then you get to drink hot sweet sap, and then by the end of the day you have this just incredible magic liquid. So I've never had that problem. I would say if you have that problem, maybe just don't drink raw sap.
Okay.
Heat it up, boil it maybe.
What did I drink? Was it raw sap?
That was raw, straight from the tree.
Okay,
sap.
Well, we'll find out.
Oh, you had a sip, you'll be fine.
I'll let you know. Hey, the pesto's amazing, man. Tell us about it.
It's basically 50-50 sorrel and garlic chives with enough olive oil to make the food processor spin and a pinch of salt.
That really is distinctive and delicious.
And I wanted to have that and the salad because, again, they're I picked these within, 20 feet of my front door.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I love so much when it's so brown and gray outside, but there are these little sort of motes of bright green, if you know where to look for them, is that it's a great mood enhancer, right? When you go outside and you get to eat something that's this fluorescent green, right?
Yeah.
But it has, to me, when you pick something fresh and bring it in and eat it in the form of a salad or make a pesto like this, it has, after a long winter buying produce from elsewhere, which is what most of us around here have to do,
yeah,
it just seems to me to contain so much information. It's got so much flavor, so much detail, so much nuance to it. And it just makes eating fun again instead of the sort of drudgery of, winter cooking.
And it reconnects you to your own soil.
Yeah, because most of the greenery that we have access to in the winter is trucked out from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it's just not fresh. And when you cut something and eat it within minutes, it's different.
I got to tell you, you ought to put that recipe. Do you have that recipe on your blog?
I will.
Yeah,
I will.
You should do that.
Yes, I will have a post up by the end of today, tomorrow morning at the latest.
Very good to dip the bread in that. Very nice. You ready to go back to the phones?
Sure, absolutely.
Here we go. Let's go over to Dave on the Mass Pike. Dave, you're on.
Hey, guys. You kind of answered my question here about intestinal issues. I'd heard that as a kid. We had about 1,000 taps that we used to collect after school during the sugaring season. And one of the wives' tales was that it could give you intestinal distress.
Well, I'll let you know.
The one other thing I wanted to ask, too, is I know after a while with the sap in the tank, it can get a little funky. And would there be any opportunity to cook with that when it's kind of soured a little?
Absolutely. Yeah, what's happening there is that the yeast and bacteria are metabolizing the sugar in the sap and converting it into lactic acid and alcohol and the things that yeast and bacteria make as waste products that we enjoy as alcohol and vinegar and other things. So absolutely, I've even cooked down partly fermented sap to make a sort of sweet and sour maple syrup, which was really interesting as like a base for a barbecue sauce or something like that. So if you start thinking more in savory applications, the slightly funky sap is super useful. Absolutely.
That's cool. Hey, one other thing too is I've always recently been thinking about, the early settlers in this region, when they come through the winter. And like you say, they're not getting any greens because it's not coming in from California okay. Just thinking of what those people would do because they're basically living out of root cellars and whatever game they could kill.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to think of what they could forage, through the winter.
Staghorn sumac is another favorite of mine. It's got those red kind of torch-shaped panicles that you see on the sides of highways, all behind parking lots. It's kind of a trash tree, but it was the Native Americans. It was one of their principal sources of vitamin C through the long winters, and it's delicious. You can use it in Iran and all over that part of the world. It's used dried as a powdered spice.
Yeah,
and I ferment it with apple cider every fall to make a beautiful kind of dark red vinegar that actually tastes somewhat like blood oranges. It's remarkable.
As a practical matter, do you really want to be foraging on the side of the highway, though?
I don't forage sumac on the side of the highway. You see it on the side of the highway.
Okay, because, they probably spray it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. No, and that's something I really can't say enough good things about going out and picking dandelions and garlic chives in your yard and making salad with them. But if you use chemicals on your yard, please don't eat things
that's a good
that you
plan.
Grow on your yard. If you are foraging in other places, like an earlier caller was talking about morels. Morels like rotting apple trees as one of the things that they grow on. If you find a disused orchard that hasn't been touched in a long time, then go to town. But if it's an existing orchard where they're spraying, mushrooms often will pick up and even concentrate some of those poisonous chemicals, so you don't want to forage there.
Peter Barrett is our guest today on Food Friday, 800-348-2551, the number. Steven in Schuylerville is on. Steven.
Hello, Ray and Peter. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, great. Oh, man, I could talk all afternoon on this subject.
It's one of my favorites.
I guess I have one comment and one question. I did a sorrel hummus at one point. I had to really put in a lot of sorrel to get the balance with the chickpeas, but it was really nice, and it had a great color.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's got a really bright lemony kind of pleasantly sort of acidic flavor to it, so it really brightens up. I think that's one of the reasons that Ray's digging this pesto so much, is that it's super bright.
Yeah, but it is really distinctive flavor.
Frequently, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Frequently, when I do a forage salad, I don't use any lemon juice or vinegar on it. I just put the sorrel in and then a drizzle of salt, pepper, and olive oil as the salad and let the sorrel speak for that.
Yeah, yeah, it's great for that. I also find later in the summer, if you grow shiso, which is used a lot in Japanese and Korean cooking especially, that sorrel and shiso make just a phenomenal combination. Shiso has this very licorice-y, cinnamony kind of thing,
and it
meshes just beautifully with the bright lemony quality of sorrel. So if you want to make a bulgogi and wrap inside your lettuce, put a leaf of shiso and then a leaf of sorrel and then the grilled meat and sauce, you won't regret it.
All right, Stephen, we have to move it along, but thank you, sir. We appreciate the call, and let's go over to John in Red Hook. John, you're on.
Hello, Ray. Hello, Chef Barron. How you doing?
Hi.
That's great. I'm not a chef, I hasten to add, but thanks.
Oh, sorry. Well, that's all right. How you doing?
Great.
Peter, Ray?
Yeah.
My question, now, hearing this conversation, there's a lot about food safety. Now, I do maple syrup, and I only drink the maple syrup that is perfectly clear, the maple water, excuse me, that's perfectly clear, not the stuff that gets a little cloudy. But I use a lot of maple water in cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I find it to be absolutely delicious. You ever used it like that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, Ray was just noshing on some pork belly that I braised in maple sap and then reduced to make a sort of sticky glaze for it on the break. So,
delicious. Yeah,
it's fantastic. Braising pork, parsnips, which I leave in the ground over the winter because they get super sweet. Dan Barber down at Blue Hill just posted something on his Instagram about how he's now proved that they get sweeter over the winter because they convert starch to sugar as a form of antifreeze, so their cell walls don't rupture in hard freezes. And so spring parsnips are much sweeter, and they have a beautiful affinity with maple sap and also coincidentally with pork. So
you can
make a pretty skippy plain food.
I've used maple water with pork, and I use a little mustard with it because it's a kind of a delicate flavor, but it's distinctly sweet.
Yes, it is. It is. It's about 2.5% sugar straight out of the tree.
All right. Hey, John, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. And who's next here? Looks like it's time for Marjorie and Saugerties. Marjorie, you're on.
Hey, how are you, Ray?
Good.
I just wanted, on your discussion about mushrooms, I worked in an ICU for a good number of years.
Yeah.
I've cared for people who have thought they were eating the proper mushroom, and you don't want to get sick in that way.
That's right, Marjorie.
100% agree.
Absolutely.
You know, it's really frightening. My husband goes out and searches for mushrooms, and we live right near Winston Farm. And so the back roads up in there are a lot of wonderful mushrooms. But he really knows what he's doing.
Yep.
And like I said, I took care of at least two people who made this horrendous mistake.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
and,
it's
you know, they literally almost died.
Yeah, it's a mistake
so
you make once. Yeah.
Absolutely. I've spent a decade learning, I would say, somewhere around half a dozen easy to ID and very good to eat species, and the rest of it I walk right by. I admire them and don't touch. You know, you can touch them, but I don't.
That's right.
Well,
yeah,
thanks,
you have
Marjorie.
To be super
well,
careful.
I just wanted to add my mushroom info.
Thank you very much. We're already scared enough. Thanks a lot. Hey,
yes,
we'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye. 800-348-2551 is the number. Peter Barrett is our guest. Cookblog.com is the website. How many viewers do you have a month on that?
I don't know. I haven't been as good as I used to. There was a period where I averaged for the first close to 10 years, I averaged a post every other day.
Yeah.
Which is sort of inconceivable.
Falling
to me
down
now.
On the job now?
Well, yeah. And also, you know, the way people look at the internet has changed. It's on mobile devices. People don't comment anymore. It's a different landscape. And I've moved on to slower projects like books. And I still do update it. I'm going to update it with info on the class that I'm teaching in Italy in the fall.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that.
It's 10 days with me in a 15th century castle in Umbria, learning how to make the local delicacies at the height of truffle season.
Are you teaching or are you learning?
I am teaching, along with a friend of mine who is the director at this castle, which is an artist residency program in the on season, and in the off season they have classes and things like that.
Oh, that's fantastic. How do people find out more about that?
At the blog, which unfortunately doesn't have the post up yet because they didn't have their site ready this morning, but they will by the end of day, so I am assured. So if you can visit cookblog.com this evening or perhaps over the weekend, there'll be all sorts of great information. Also, my Instagram is cookblog. That I update daily with all kinds of shots of what I'm picking and cooking and eating, and that will have updates as the season progresses.
We need the pesto recipe up at some
point. Yes, it will be really soon, I promise.
Let's go over to line four, and Don and Wilton. Don, you're on.
Oh, I wanted to add to your discussion about fiddlehead ferns.
Okay.
Two points. One is that you'll be able to find most of the time right along streams. That's where you'll find most. But on a safety point, make sure that you don't pick the ones that are fuzzy like a cat hair. You want the ones with onion skins. And sometimes they'll grow close to each other, so that's a big safety issue.
That's a good point. Yes, the smooth ones are what you want, not the fuzzy ones. Thank you for pointing that out.
They look just like an onion skin on them.
So, again, be forewarned, be forearmed. Don, thanks a lot for the call, and let's go on over to line eight now. And Ted in Shelburne, Vermont. Ted.
Yes, thank you very much. We're having a snow globe afternoon here in Shelburne. It's coming on down white. Because I had forgotten it and just came to mind, but I have a small patch of nettles, which you may find wild, but I don't get intimate with them really, but you can touch them carefully with your fingers and snip them with scissors and then get them into boiling water, but they're highly nutritious.
They are. I'm so glad you called because nettles were actually at the top of my list of things I wanted to talk about, but it's just a tiny bit early, so my spots aren't yielding right now. I mean, they're half an inch tall.
They're not there yet. And then when they get a little old or ugly or buggy or something, the lawnmower kind of gets you a fresh batch.
Yeah, it's so true. And they regrow in the fall, even if you don't mow them.
Start over. And dandelions, I like to harvest. I mean, in the spring, I used to be pretty fussy about not letting that bud even start to have a stem under it just when they're fresh spring tonic in the spring. But I cut them about an inch below the soil surface and just get that scuzzy skin off them, which can stain your fingers some. But I just think the nutrition is there, and I don't know the facts on that. I'd love it, Ray, if you ever connected with a nutritionist wild harvester.
People have been telling me to contact a nutritionist for quite some time. I'll try.
This is a professional question about wild crafting.
Okay, well, that's cool, Ted. Well, thank you very much. We're about out of time.
Just interesting. And also mint. I one time took some mint. I was sort of into mint tea, and I took some out to a sugar house and just made not very sweetened up, but just boiled. I think boiling has a lot to do with this, whether it bothers your stomach or not. But just sap and mint in it for mint tea. That's a very good flavor combination.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ted, we'll have to leave it there.
I will let you go. I see the clock is running. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the call, and good luck with the snow up there, Ted. All right, before we go, you know, I kind of dissed dandelion wine. Not my favorite thing, but you brought booze, and it's delicious. Tell us in the last minute what this is.
This is a cassis, which is a blackcurrant liqueur. Mm. There are some pros making really top-notch versions of it up and down the Hudson Valley. My version is a little more home cook-friendly. I took some grain alcohol and soaked a ton of my homegrown black currants. Also, I need to boost black currants. Everyone should grow currants. They're fantastic, super low maintenance, highly pest tolerant. They grow in partial sun, just terrific. So I took my black currants, soaked them in high proof booze for, I'm going to say, a month or so.
Yeah.
Strained it out and then diluted a little with water because it's grain alcohol. It's not. You could use vodka if you wanted to just drink it straight.
Right.
And then I added some maple syrup to sweeten, and that's it. There's nothing else in it.
Really delicious drink you got there. Well, I got to say, Peter Barrett, this was a lot of fun today.
Thank you. I had fun too.
And people want to learn more about what you have going on. They go where?
Cookblog.com or just plain cookblog on Instagram are the two best places. Instagram's the thing if you want daily thing, and you can message me on there. My contact info is on the blog. If you want mailing list info for the Italy classes or some of the classes that I cook in my home, in Saugerties, just drop me a line or questions, recipes, anything. I will have a pesto recipe up shortly.
Good.
And yeah.
And, you know, it was a lot of fun having you here, and the book is phenomenal, and good luck, continued good luck with that one. Maybe you make a book about the 13 days in Italy.
That's not the worst idea anyone's ever had.
All right, but I don't know how you can teach and take pictures. And
it's a little tricky. All right. It's a little tricky, but if it goes well, there'll be others.
All right, man. Well, thanks for being here. Support comes from Troy Waterfront Farmers Market, featuring over 80 local farms and fresh food vendors every week all winter long. Open every Saturday, 9 to 2 in the Troy Atrium, troymarket.org. Blue Heron Restaurant and Catering, located in the Old Town Hall, Sunderland, Massachusetts, serving globally inspired, locally sourced cuisine. Open for dinner Tuesday through Sunday at 5, blueherondining.com. Denizen Farm, Scaticoke, providing the capital region with organic vegetables through farmers markets and CSA. 2018 CSA sign-up now available at denizenfarm.com. And Berkshire Country Day, an independent pre-K to 9 school, comprehensive curriculum and an emphasis on community. Open house May 10th, intentional, independent, inspired, berkshirecountryday.org. Thanks again to Peter Barrett for being with us. Thank you for some great calls today and great emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Barb King took your calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Thanks again this week for being with us on Vox Pop. Alan will be back on Monday in the big chair for a Medical Monday. Have a great weekend. Stand by now for news.